I think the positive is it's one of the isms. You talk about disablism, racism, sexism. I feel like when someone actually engages with a disabled person, some of the misconceptions drop away maybe a bit quicker than with the other isms. I don't know, you know, the listeners might have other experiences, but I felt that it does, those prejudices drop away quite quickly once someone interacts and sees you as a person, and in my case, doesn't see the wheelchair. But I think for those that are not as, you know, having disabled friends or involved or, you know, coming into contact with disabled people, the perception definitely is around pity and sympathy, that because you're in the chair and you have something that's not, you know, as known or as typical, must mean that life is awful and, you know, things must be terrible. So I think there's a lot of, a lot of pity and sympathy that people maybe presume. I think sometimes people have a view around intelligence and intellectual capability. Sort of see that because you're sat down on in a chair on wheels, that then maybe cognitively or emotionally you're not going to be as capable. And of course, when we talk about disability, it's a wide spectrum, and that's something that we'll maybe come on to a bit later in terms of, you know, with the job at the charity in London and doing the things I've done self-employed since, I've embraced beyond what it is to be disabled in the way I am, but to understand what it is to be deaf or blind and other, you know, different conditions. So, but yeah, for the misconceptions people have with me, then there's definitely a lot around whether there's a lack of language, let alone intellectual capability. But of course, once they start talking to me, that does fall away quite quickly.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Martin, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So I actually came across your story because you had sent me an email, and I was immediately intrigued by a number of different things. One being that you just sold a company to Airbnb, but more than that, the story in general was fascinating to me. So before we get into all that, I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living, and what impact did what your parents did for a living end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Sure. So my dad has been involved in financial services and insurance. And I can remember from a long time ago that his general recommendation was not to go into that world. I think he found that he was good at it and it's paid the bills. But there sort of would be more out there for his son and for me to get stuck into. So I definitely remember those childhood conversations really clearly, even to this day. And then my mum, when I was, you know, sort of first born and a young child, she was a stay-at-home mum. And then she got involved with a local leisure centre, sort of working in the cafe part-time. And then she actually became a lifeguard and then a swimming teacher. So I think that's inspired me a lot, that once you find something that you enjoy and you're good at and you have that connection with people that you click with, she sort of went on to spend 20 years now at this local leisure centre having a lot of good fun, teaching kids to swim and having a real community feel there as well.
Mm-hmm. And how did that influence your choices? I mean, did you make career choices? But I mean, obviously from your dad, that seems pretty clear that you would make choice not to do anything that you hated. And from your mom, I'm curious what impact that had on the choices that you've made.
Yeah, I mean, the big defining moment with my career is I sort of went to university. I did a degree in economics, master's in marketing. I was all kind of gearing up to go off into some sort of financial job, which again, that, you know, kind of at that point would have been very similar to my dad's career choices as well. Partly for the listeners to know, I'm in a wheelchair. I have something called spinal muscular atrophy, which means that physically I'm really limited in the things I can do. So I have to rely on an electric wheelchair, on personal care support, on adapted vehicles and public transport, and, you know, buildings have to be all sort of accessible for the wheelchair. And I think university was a big step getting used to sort of not having my mum and dad help with my care needs and, you know, sort of that whole part of my life. And that was a big founding moment for me to sort of spread my wings and go and get drunk till the early hours of the next morning with my friends and, you know, have other paid carers that would sort of assist me drunk often as well from their side to get into bed. So yeah, sort of having gone through uni, I think I was looking for the job market. And, you know, I don't want to say that there was lots of discrimination. I think some people were wary of my ability to do a full-time job with a disability. But I think also I maybe had a fear and a lack of confidence as well at the time about how that might play out. So in the end, I sort of looked for a more comfortable stepping stone by getting a job at a disability charity. And it wasn't something I'd ever looked to do in all of my childhood and university years, both sort of socially and with the academic achievements I'd got. But it just felt that if I could get the sort of, you know, foot on the career ladder, start earning some money, get a bit of learning and development, get used to a full-time job, then I could sort of maybe look to even go back to some of the financial services stuff. And I think that definitely there was a lot of pragmatism that I got from my mum. I know that for her bringing me up and my sister who isn't disabled, the job that she got at the local leisure centre really fit around her life and her lifestyle. So I think a lot of pragmatism came from her. But also I think that sort of general zest for being with people and helping people came from my mum, and that's sort of reflected in the job that she does as a local community person as well.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when, was this a disability where you were born with, or is it something that took place over the course of your life, and how did it impact your early sort of childhood and that part of your life?
Yeah, so it's a genetic condition. So I think in the UK there's like 2,500 people living with the condition. So it's a pretty rare genetic disability. I guess, you know, in terms of how it affected the early childhood, I don't have loads of memories of feeling disabled. When I went to like the nursery, we call it in England, like the kindergarten, you know, all of the people around me weren't in a wheelchair. So I went to a sort of inclusive nursery, and the same with the primary school. But I know in later life that mum and dad had to do quite a lot of sort of speaking to the teachers and getting funding that enabled me to have an assistant to help me through my day. So I guess in the early years, my mum and dad bared the brunt of any of the societal barriers and some of the prejudices that did undoubtedly go on about sort of how people viewed disabled people in education and in society. But for me, I mean, up to the age of 11, I don't remember feeling that different. I used to play soccer or football with my school friends and go down the park after school, and they'd all be running around and I'd be cruising in my wheelchair, which had quite a good sort of top speed on it. Even though I was quite young, I was driving this pretty heavy bit of machinery around, and I was able to sort of manipulate the ball and, you know, kind of get stuck in and play soccer with them. So yeah, for overall, the early years were actually very happy and very included, but very much thanks to my mum and dad fighting the battles without me really knowing about it.
So you mentioned that you didn't feel that way, you know, disabled until age 11. So I'm curious what happened at age 11 that changed how you felt about this.
Sure. So in the UK, I don't know how it is over in the US, but we changed schools at the age of 11. So I, you know, the idea would have been I'd have gone from this local village school in Cambridgeshire. So I grew up about half an hour from Cambridge itself. And then, yeah, basically it sort of, I would have gone to the local secondary school 2 miles away and carried on being with all my friends and furthering my education into to the sort of teen years and beyond. But the local secondary school wasn't wheelchair accessible. So again, I've, you know, I remember hearing some bits about it when I was 10 or 11, but more in later life, I've heard the stories that there were lots of meetings with the head teacher and the local authorities. And yeah, just looking at kind of how can they facilitate me being at a school that had really bad wheelchair access and wouldn't have had some of the other facilities that I might have benefited from, you know, like a swimming pool with a hoist or, you know, there's other bits and bobs that the school felt I should have, but they couldn't provide. So, yeah, in the end, I had to go to a school about 20 minutes, half an hour on a good day, and it involved a mini bus with a tail lift on it, going around this sort of a part of the county and picking up those people with disabilities like myself and then taking us to this other school that was more geared up and inclusive. And obviously that was gut-wrenching, you know, to have to leave behind all my friends. It was one class per year. It was a small village. We were all very close and we all knew each other, or everyone in our years and even just above and below. And so, yeah, it was really, really sad to not be able to hang out with them as much, and not only not be able to hang out with them as much, but have to go on this quite long journey for an 11-year-old at least, and be on a bus with disabled people. And I wasn't, as I mentioned before, I was in a very mainstream sort of education situation, but I always joke now that I was the only disabled in the village, because it really was, no one else had a disability in my whole circle. So it actually took a bit of learning and getting used to what other disabled people were like and what their challenges were, and sort of working out how that fitted in with my identity, because I'd not really identified as being disabled, as I mentioned to you earlier. So there was a lot of interesting dynamics just being on that bus and sort of getting used to that world. And then, of course, once I got to the school, you know, that there was a lot more support and a lot more wheelchair access, a lot more facilities, but I had to start out from scratch and make new friends in my classes, and that was pretty scary as well. And I really had a lot of anxiety at the time, and I've always had a weaker stomach when I get nervous, without being too graphic, but I used to, you know, literally be physically sick some mornings because of the nerves that I was experiencing with all these changes at the time.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Squarespace. It's the beginning of the year, and chances are that you have a creative project or idea that you want to get off the ground this year. Whether it's writing a book, starting a blog, or building a business, Squarespace can help. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks, and everything is optimized for mobile out of the box, and they have built-in search engine optimization and 24/7 award-winning customer support. A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code UNMISTAKABLE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. I'm curious what the impact of your disability has been on your social relationships, like with friends, with, you know, potential romantic partners. I'm just curious, like, what's been the impact of it? What was it like when you were younger, and how has it changed throughout the course of your life? And how has your own sort of internal story about this impacted those relationships?
Yeah, I suppose the teen years were tricky, but really the way I think they're tricky for every teenager, just the hormones and the working out who you are and what you want to do as a general point of view, almost separate to the disability. I think, yeah, that was a difficult time. But in terms of friendships, I mean, from nursery to primary to secondary school, and then later on to university, and then into the workplace as well, you know, I've always been quite an outgoing, happy-go-lucky person. I think that does play a big factor. I think if you're, you know, in a wheelchair and you're more shy and introverted, there's an extra barrier to try and overcome. So I guess I have a bit of luck that I've been, you know, given that personality type of being quite optimistic and I'll just talk to anybody. But yeah, in the end, I've always made good friends and they've always just included me as one of the gang. And I've never felt that they saw me any differently to the others that weren't disabled. I think the biggest barrier, and I talk quite a lot about barriers in my work and my writing, we talk about the social model of disability, mm-hmm. and that's where you look at the barriers of the environment, the barriers of attitudes, and the barriers of procedures and processes. And so within the friendship group, the attitude was fine, but whenever we wanted to go out and, you know, watch a film or go to a bar in the later years or whatever it might have been, there was always this limitation with what we could do because, you know, the world's getting better, but there is still quite a lot of the world that is not really geared up for wheelchair users and for disabled people with other types of disabilities as well. So I would say that the biggest barrier has always been and remains to be finding the establishment that you want to go to for a leisure pursuit that is open and adapted and suitable for someone in a wheelchair. So yeah, I definitely think that that's been the biggest barrier. In terms of identity, I think despite being at secondary school and being around other disabled people, I used to play wheelchair hockey at lunchtime, so there are a lot of fond memories of being with some of the other guys in wheelchairs, even though a lot of the people in my actual classes weren't with a disability. We had this sort of special unit where there was the physios and the assistants, and you could get help with, you know, eating a lunch or going to the toilet and things that, you know, needed a bit more help with. So I did strike up good friendships with other disabled people, and we really bonded over sport and playing wheelchair hockey. And I think a big part of that for me was how at primary school I played football, but I was at a big disadvantage because I was in the wheelchair and trying to, you know, bounce the ball around as best I could with the wheelchair. Whereas playing hockey, I had a lot more control over what I did with the ball because I had better upper body movement then than I maybe do now, because my condition does sort of deteriorate a little bit over time. But also everyone else playing wheelchair hockey was in the same position, so it was more of an equal sport, and I really got a lot of joy out of playing that every lunchtime. But I don't think any of those friendships and interaction with disabled people maybe prompted me to look at my self-identity and image around disability. I think that more happened at university. I suppose the big prompt of why that would be the case was, although I had assistance at school, it wasn't till university that the carers I had around me had to help me with more things like showering and going to the toilet and basically very full-on personal care and helping me turn over at night time, because I thought I need to have assistance to roll over in the night a couple of times because I can't do that myself. And so, yeah, not relying on my mum and dad to do those more personal things was really another difficult step. And I think in being faced with these strangers that had also never done care before, they were obviously scared of what was involved. I was scared what was involved. And I think that really started to hit home that my life is, or was and is, quite different from the average person. I suppose that did have a consequential self-analysis of what it actually meant to have spinal muscular atrophy, which is the name of the disability, and to use the wheelchair and all the rest of it. It definitely had a light shone on it at university, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Think the concept of unmistakable, making things so distinctive that your competition becomes irrelevant, would be inspiring to employees or attendees at your company event or conference? If so, visit unmistakablecreative.com/speaking to learn more, submit your contact info, and we'll be in touch.
What misperceptions do you think that people have about people like you and disabled people in general?
I think the positive is it's one of the isms. You talk about disabledism, racism, sexism. I feel like when someone actually engages with a disabled person, some of the misconceptions drop away maybe a bit quicker than with the other isms. I don't know, the listeners might have other experiences, but I felt that it does, those prejudices drop away quite quickly once someone interacts and sees you as a person, and in my case doesn't see the wheelchair. But I think for those that are not as having disabled friends or involved or coming into contact with disabled people, the perception definitely is around pity and sympathy, that because you're in the chair and you have something that's not as known or as typical, must mean that life is awful and things must be terrible. So I think there's a lot of pity and sympathy that people maybe presume. I think sometimes people have a view around intelligence and intellectual capability. So to see that because you're sat down in a chair on wheels, that then maybe cognitively or emotionally you're not going to be as capable. And of course, when we talk about disability, it's a wide spectrum, and that's something that we'll maybe come on to a bit later in terms of with the job at the charity in London and doing the things I've done self-employed since, I've embraced beyond what it is to be disabled in the way I am, but to understand what it is to be deaf or blind and other different conditions. So but yeah, for the misconceptions people have with me, then there's definitely a lot around whether there's a lack of language, let alone intellectual capability. But of course, once they start talking to me, that does fall away quite quickly. And a humorous level and vibe is around sexual interactions, that the amount of, I think in the daytime, and maybe it's more of a British thing, I don't know, but us Brits were quite cautious, and we don't want to be too intrusive to people. So I think in the daytime people are more scared to ask why I'm in the chair and what it involves, and they'd rather just sort of steer a bit clear and avoid any potential awkwardness. But as soon as you give a pint of beer or a wine or a spirit to someone, they suddenly overcome the inhibitions and decide that actually it's perfectly normal to ask a stranger who's in a wheelchair in a nightclub or a bar whether they're able to have sex. And that certainly is an icebreaker when I've been out, sort of boozing and cruising on the streets of London, that total strangers suddenly feel comfortable enough to ask those kind of questions. So yeah, there's certainly some quite comical moments having life of a disability as well.
There's something you said earlier in our conversation about barriers, and you mentioned three things in particular. You said environment, attitude, and processes and procedures, and I'm curious if you could expand on what those are and how they relate to barriers.
Sure. So the environmental barriers are when engaging with your house or vehicle, public transport or buildings, that there aren't disabling barriers. So a lot, the reason it's certainly in Britain that we say disabled people more than people with disabilities or handicaps or other terms is that the disability movement go by this thing called the social model of disability, which is all about these three barriers that we're talking about now. And in the end, it's the barriers that disable the person. So of course, I am a person first and foremost, which is why some people say people with a disability. But the argument is that if we reduce the barriers or knock down all of these barriers, then it's not disabled people, it's just people. And so the best example I can give on the environmental side is that if I go to a building, maybe go to a concert or something like that, see my favorite band, then if there are steps to get in the door, then I am disabled. But if there is a ramp or level access or an elevator, then I'm totally enabled. Does that make sense for that example?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then so with attitudes, if a person has the misconceptions that we just talked about, that disables me because it's very difficult to strike up friendships or relationships or, you know, get a job, whatever else it might be, if people's attitudes are presuming something about you that isn't to be true. So that's also disabling. And then with the processes, the best example is the train, the National Rail in Britain, from my experiences, is around we have to call at least 24 hours before to have the ramp brought to the train from an assistant that works at every station that you're visiting. So the difficulty with that process is sometimes you may not know that you're going to go on a train the next day. You might just wake up one morning and think, hey, I'm just going to go, you know, like I'm back out in Cambridgeshire now. I might say, hey, I'm going to go to London and just spend a day in London tomorrow. But I can't do that because I have to let them know at least the day before. And the other thing is that when you're going somewhere, maybe for a meeting, whether it be social or for work, you don't always know what time you're going to come back. But when you actually book the assistance, they need to know what train you're getting and, you know, exactly sort of when you'll be returning as well, and any stops in the middle if you're going somewhere a bit further. And I've had some terrible experiences over the years. The big sort of famous one, I actually got asked to speak on BBC One or on BBC Breakfast to raise awareness about this, was how I was coming back from university to visit my family. And we had to stop off about halfway to change trains. And then I think we got to the final destination, actually. And the person that was meant to bring the ramp didn't come, even though I had done the procedure of phoning in advance. And basically it resulted with my girlfriend at the time getting off the train, going to look for someone to bring the ramp to get me off, and the train doors closed, and then I was just firing off down the track to the wrong destination on my own. And I think back in, because this was sort of 2003, I can't remember if I had my mobile phone on me then or not, but it resulted in all sorts of difficulties of trying to get me off the train at the next accessible station, coming back on the train afterwards. And I think I got home or back to the original destination station 2 hours late, all because of this mix up with the ramp. So yeah, the procedure is as disabling as are the perceptions and as are the built up environment as well.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Srini, and I just want to say thanks for listening. If you're finding our show inspiring or thought-provoking, the biggest thing that you can do to support us is to share the show with someone else who you think would find these conversations valuable. And with most podcast apps, you can just send a link via text. Thanks again for listening to the show. So walk me through, you know, working at the nonprofit to getting to the, you know, work that you're doing today and selling a company.
Yeah, it's been a cool journey, but not always sort of the absolute highs that, you know, the highlight reel sounds very impressive, but obviously there's been all the kind of doubts and the worries of, am I on the right route and are we doing well enough for the community that we serve? And so yeah, there's obviously been a roller coaster through that period. So as I mentioned, my first job was at the not-for-profit called Scope. And I started out in the human resources department. Again, like I mentioned earlier, not because I was destined and, you know, always wishing to work in the HR department. But I think there was an advert in a paper and it was saying that this not-for-profit were trying to get more disabled people into work. And so while the role wasn't the big pull factor, it was that they were really looking to fill. We don't have quotas from the government for disabled workers, that there's not a legal enforcement for companies, but I guess a not-for-profit who exists to make the world more accessible for disabled people, they felt that about 20% of their workforce should have some kind of disability. And that's reflected in the fact that around 20% of society has some sort of disability as well. So they were on this big recruitment drive to get more disabled people there. So I wrote the application, I got called for interview, I got called for a second interview. I wasn't nervous because I knew that they were pretty clued up with what it meant to have a disability. And although every disability is different, they would never know my exact needs and my exact solutions in the workplace. I knew that they would be very communicative and wanting to work with me, you know, to make my time there a success. And at that time, I was living back home with my parents. So I did the 4 years at Coventry University and then came back to Cambridgeshire for a year, did the work at Scope that happened to have an office quite locally, and then decided that I really wanted to spread my wings again. So after a few months of getting my sort of feet under the table and learning the ropes, I then started to go on a couple of training courses in their London head office. And then I suppose one thing led to another, where the idea of living and working in London was a lifelong dream. So that was still in full effect in the back of my mind. And then rather than changing jobs and having the stress of going to other interviews or new employment, I was able to apply for a new job internally, and it was still in the HR team as well. So that worked out really well that I was able to make that transition between the two similar roles, but from Cambridgeshire to London. The fun then began that, so when I turned 18, I got a budget from the local government to pay for my care support. So when I was in Coventry University — Coventry is near to Birmingham, which is in the Midlands, so anyone that doesn't quite know the geography of England, that's the lay of the land. So when I was there, the funding still came from Cambridge because I was still registered there, just obviously being a student in Coventry. But when I moved to London, I had to completely move residency, and that meant that I had to get the funding for my care support from the London borough rather than sort of just keep the money from the local Cambridgeshire council. And that was really difficult because, in fact, it was prior to the crash, but since we had the big financial crash in 2008, austerity has hit a lot of public spending. And, you know, it makes sense that the crash caused a lot of knock-on consequences and everyone has had to tighten their belts and struggle. But I think it has hit disabled people and other some minority groups, but particularly those that have more connection with poverty as well. There's been a lot of difficulties because of the crash. And also, if you think you rely on the government for the care support and buying the wheelchair, and I know in America some of the system is a bit different to the UK, but broadly the things that you need to live independently tend to come from the government in a more developed world. And then obviously by working, you're still able to earn enough of an income to get your own house and buy your own food and go on your own holidays and have a good, you know, typical life. But it's unlikely that you're going to make so much money, particularly when you're just starting out like everybody else, that would also cover the cost of all those equipment and carers. So moving to London prior to the crash, they were still trying to give menial budgets. And the basic effect of not having enough budget is that I can't pay the person that's with me to help me cook and clean and have a shower and go to the toilet. So it would have been very difficult, if not impossible, to have stayed in London. But luckily, I got some advocacy groups and general, you know, help and support from even from the not-for-profit that I work for. And finally, I was able to get the budget that I needed. But that was quite a, you know, an upheaval to get that to work. And the other thing was housing. When I was at university, I was in the halls, and they were a couple of the rooms were adapted, and the kitchen was made a bit bigger, so it was more suitable for wheelchair users in particular, and other ways for other types of disabilities. When I knew that I'd got the job in London, it was really difficult to find a house that would have the wheelchair access and the roll-in shower, so I'm able to, obviously I'm not able to get over the bigger barrier of a bath. I have to use a sort of open plan wet room shower. So again, the whole housing thing was pretty stressful. So it took a few months just to settle in to London and into that job. And then once I'd probably done 6 months in the new role, there was a couple of roles in a different department in the fundraising team. And I suppose having done economics and particularly having done marketing, it made more sense to not be in HR forever, but to be in a more sort of marketing-y role. So I worked for about a year, I think it was, doing the kind of thing that a lot of not-for-profits do, where they get people to give direct debits and they acquire those donors through telemarketing or street fundraising or direct mail shots, lots of different mediums to get people to give to the not-for-profit. So I was project managing and training the actual fundraisers that then went out and did the acquisition, the recruitment on the ground. And so that then gave me a lot of grounding on what the whole concept of the social model that we talked about before, gave me a lot of grounding in running training sessions as well, and traveling. I had to go around all different parts of the country on a kind of roadshow every year to get the fundraisers prepped and trained on what they needed to do for this not-for-profit. And then I did another role towards the end of my time that more took the services that the not-for-profit offered, and they were very far ranging, from schools to care homes to helplines and lots of other different things, and then basically sit between the services and the fundraising team of how they could then sell those services to bring in the vital money that they needed. And it was around that time that I met our mutual friend, AJ Leon and Melissa Leon from Misfit. I think they were starting out earlier on in their career, and they did a conference, a workshop at the Institute of Fundraising, all about the power of social media and social change and storytelling. And I was just blown away and inspired about what they were doing, but also the tools and the strategies that I could use for myself, and to start maybe looking at projects that I think would be suitable for disabled people. And it was never a negative about scope, the not-for-profit, and they have definitely, since I've moved on, they've done a lot more with the sort of digital world. But I did start to feel a bit frustrated that they were more traditional in their approach. So from that, seeing AJ and Melissa at the workshop, I asked if I could meet them for a coffee. Then they helped me to start up my blog, which is martinsibby.com. And it was just really, AJ and Melissa said to me, just write about whatever it is you experience with your disability. Buy a flip cam, just make some video blogs as well. Don't overthink it. Don't be too, you know, perfectionism, which I think we all have that tendency. I know I would have done if they hadn't have said that to me. And no one else was really blogging with a disability at the time. So really that sort of starting out on the side of my job just blew up, and people just loved seeing me, whether I was going out in London or talking about even my work. But then when I would go on a holiday, we went to like a road trip in California and Las Vegas, so I documented that. And I think people, I guess it changed those misconceptions for some people that had them in the first place, and they didn't have to come up to someone like me and ask me. It was just there online to kind of observe and learn about what it is for someone to be disabled. But I think really what's grabbed me is that other disabled people that were struggling with care or housing or uni or working saw someone, I was only in my mid to late 20s at the time, and they just saw someone that was living the dream, and that resonated. And then we sort of started to have meetups and workshops, and you know, it really created a tsunami, I suppose, of what has then happened as a result of starting the blog.
Hey, it's Srini. I wanted to tell you about our new online course called Distraction Mastery. In this course, you'll learn exactly how to eliminate time-robbing distractions, master your attention, and get in the zone on command. In under 10 minutes a day, you'll learn a proven, powerful framework for killing distractions and developing unshakable focus based on proven research and experience. These are the exact strategies that I've personally used to write 2 books and hundreds of articles. So, to learn more, visit courses.unmistakablecreative.com. Again, that's courses.unmistakablecreative.com. Mm-hmm. So how do you go from the blog to selling a company to Airbnb?
Yeah, so I started my blog in 2009. With Shrin Adipali. He was a friend from childhood with the same condition that I've got. And on our infamous trip around California and Vegas, we said that the blog's going good, but it would be great to have a magazine that had stories from other disabled people. So we co-founded Disability Horizons magazine, which is really, it's another blog. It's not a print paper version. It's all online. But instead of it always being my stories, we then curated content from our friends and acquaintances, and gradually the community itself grew. So I think in about a year or two, we went up to about 20,000 people in the community. And then we were looking at, you know, we're both from sort of business backgrounds as well, and we both wanted to leave our day jobs. As much as we had good points about it, we wanted to, you know, be more autonomous, start our own things, go and travel a bit more while we were working. And I think what we thought in the beginning was to copy a lot of the information businesses and entrepreneurs, and that we could just start to create guides and webinars and workshops and just sell them to our audience. But as I mentioned, with the implications of the crash, but even just the general amount of barriers that disabled people face, it is still a lot harder to be independent and to get a good job and all the rest of it. So I think we felt that partly our audience may not all have the means to pay for all of the content that we knew that they needed and wanted. Another factor, of course, is with not-for-profits, they were providing similar stuff for free because they already fundraised for it, but we didn't want to go down the charity route. We wanted to be a business. We wanted to stand on its own feet and to, you know, kind of give value directly in the marketplace rather than just have the sort of constantly filling out applications to try and get charitable funding, which of course is always highly competitive and difficult to get hold of, when particularly when you're starting out as a new outfit as well. And so we toyed with that information model, and then we felt what we needed to do was create a product that we would bolt into the community of the magazine. So we toyed with an app that would show local accessibility to bars and restaurants and things like that. But it was really difficult to get enough funding to get the tech right, but also to get the sort of scalability of both the establishments to be involved and to get enough users, disabled users, to upload reviews and reports. And, you know, since we looked at that, there are people doing it, and even Google Maps is doing it now as well. So we were in the right area, but there was a few too many barriers to entry for that business. And so in the end, we looked at the travel model, because by that point we got the bug, and we were just traveling all over the place. I mean, in the end, I've been to USA a few times. I've been to Japan, Australia, Mexico, and all around Europe on road trips that we crowdfunded. And, you know, we were having the time of our life traveling while we were creating all of this content as well. So we felt that travel would be a good area to do product development, because there are plenty of disabled people with expendable income. The barrier for them isn't financial to go on holiday. It's more the information of where to go, you know, where the hotels are accessible, where the local sort of streets have drop curbs or braille or whatever else is necessary. So we started looking into really an accommodation website that at some point later we could bolt on tours and other things as well. And we called it the Airbnb for disabled people, and the actual name of the company is Accommable. And then as we started out, we got some local, well, not local, but small businesses that had purposefully made their property very accessible, but found that not many people were coming with a disability because they didn't know about it. So they were really happy that we were coming along. We work with tourist boards, we work with not-for-profits in the accessible tourism space. And just to give an idea, I think in England last year, £12 million was spent just on disabled people going on an overnight stay in some kind of leisure way. So you can see that there is a market of disabled people that are willing and able to travel. So we tried to get some startup funding, and we got a little bit from the Skull Foundation. AJ and Melissa were always there giving us some advice and support as well, which was really, really helpful. And then, yeah, as things developed, I think Shrin learned to code, and that was where we overcame the big barrier. And this whole conversation ends up being about barriers, whether you're disabled or not. And he was able to create our beta version to really sort of showcase what we were actually banging on about with all of our presentations and conversations. So then we got some angel investment of over 200,000, it was £250,000. And that enabled the team to scale up more and get a bit more engineering clout and, you know, just get the whole thing to grow. And then we, as always, with a startup, you come to a bit of a crossroads, and that happened about 2 months ago. I've not been as involved the last year in the business because it needed a lot more product development, whereas I've always been more around the community content and the marketing. So obviously that could have come later on once the product was a bit more set up to have had more properties in more of the world. But even so, there was about 1,000 properties up to a couple of months ago. And then Shrin, who was more leading on the efforts and was the CEO, approached Airbnb, and conversations went on. And then, yeah, it was Airbnb bought Accommable about a month ago. So we were all over the news, all over BBC in England and various other networks around the world, that our little startup company that two friends with a disability kind of started from a garage. Not that we actually had a garage, but it's the stereotypical entrepreneur story. We sold it to the company that we were reading about and aspiring to be like for our particular community. So it was pretty cool stuff.
Wow. You know, I think the really interesting thing for me, just from having heard your whole story, is that despite so many barriers in your life, you've maintained this sort of level of optimism and faith in your ability to go out and live in the way that you do. And on the sort of flip side of that, I see people who have, you know, circumstances and barriers that are far less adverse than anything that you've had to deal with, yet they don't respond to them the same way that you've responded to yours. And I'm curious why you think that is.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier the sort of identity and self-image of being disabled. So I suppose over time, I did have to understand that I do have limits. I do get times where I'm tired or my health suffers in the winter, and I just have to understand and be realistic. So I think rather than just pushing through towards the big dreams without any thoughts of reality and limits would be a mistake. I've had to become very self-aware and very well planned and researched in all of my endeavors, whether to do with access or just, you know, as any business and entrepreneurial person would be. Interestingly, where I've got to with work is that I know that the disabled community need a lot more support and encouragement and even just tools and strategies in around their self-esteem, in the knowledge of how to cope with some of these barriers and with peer-to-peer support. And I think having been through a lot of personal development courses and seminars and just reading lots, and I'm always subscribed to your blog emails that come through, and so all of those inputs have helped me to understand more of what I do well and what I do bad, and then focus on my strengths and my passions and my enjoyment. But as of the turn of the year, going into January, I'm launching a personal development zone under Disability Horizons. That's the main part that I now work on. And so, yeah, I'm really sort of looking hard at everything I've done and Shrin has done and others like us to pass that knowledge on to disabled people to go out and get their own dreams off the ground and realize their own potential. And I think any of the listeners that, you know, clearly some and many won't have a connection to disability, but I think a lot of those lessons are the same, that it really is about the mindset, no matter what is going on physically or economically, all the other factors we have in life. If we do have intention of what we want from life and what we're capable of, but also know there'll be those roller coaster moments that I mentioned at the beginning, that it wasn't all plain sailing and there were dark days as well, but accept those for what they are, then, you know, as the book I wrote, I called it Everything Is Possible, because I really do believe, disabled or not, that we can do whatever we set out to do.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. So I don't want to wrap by asking my final question, which I know you've heard me ask before. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's trying. I think literally we're unmistakable by just getting out there and trying, no matter what happens, no matter what the end result is. It's better to regret the things we did than to regret the things that we didn't. And I know we've read those types of sound bites in lots of books and you know, podcasts, listen to them on podcasts, but I really feel overall that is truly what, for me, makes someone, you know, unmistakable.
Wow. Awesome. Well, where can people learn more about you and your work?
My blog is martinsibley.com. The magazine is disabilityhorizons.com, which we're also getting that out across the world in other languages. It's in Arabic, and we're seeing a lot of uptake and sort of activism coming from the launch we've done in Arabic-speaking countries, which is really exciting new chapter as well. But yeah, I guess the main thing is social media, Facebook, LinkedIn. I'm a blogger, so I'm everywhere, basically.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.